We're trying to get to 10,000 eggs, and the reason I pushed this is because my wife's involved. And I got to do this for her. But anyway. Bill, I didn't give you any passage. Esther 4, 1 through 17, if you can. This morning we began looking at the book of Esther, and we begin looking at it in part because I suppose that there's a lot of flavor to it, but I think more than that, the book of Esther takes place in a culture I think that is very similar to our own, as we talked about this morning. It was a culture where the believers, in this case the Jews, were in a great empire, and you and I live, I think, in a great empire. But it was a very secular empire. And our empire, the American empire, is becoming increasingly secular. It was an empire where there was a lot of power in the hands of a few. It was an empire that was very sexual in nature. There was tremendous pressure on the people to come under the wider culture. And I think that's something that you and I deal with. I think from the time we go into a public school, and again, in East Tennessee is very much part of the Bible Belt, and we don't feel it maybe to the degree that other places do, but from the time you go into the public school system, I think you start to feel the pressure to conform to the culture. And that's in attitudes, that's in the way that you think, that's in how you view moral issues. And I think that that's where they were in the Persian Empire. And so we looked at some of the issues this morning. I want to go to chapter 4, and I'll talk about what's in chapter 2 and 3. But Bill, if you've got chapter 4, I'm going to read it. I broke my $1.25 reading glasses this morning. I got to go down to Dollar Tree and get some more. When Mordecai learned all that had happened, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes, a way of mourning, and he went out into the midst of the city. He cried out with a loud and bitter cry. And he went as far as the front of the king's gate, for no one might enter into the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. And in every province where the king's command and decree arrived, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting, weeping, and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. So Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her, and the queen was deeply distressed. And then she sent garments to clothe Mordecai and take his sackcloth away from him, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs whom he had appointed to attend her. And she gave him a command concerning Mordecai to learn what and why this was. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the city square that was in the front of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the sum of the money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries to destroy the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the written decree for their destruction, which was given in Shushan, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her, and that he might command her to go into the king to make supplication to him and plead before him for her people. So Hathach returned and told Esther the words of Mordecai. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and gave him a command for Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king, who has not been called, he has but one law: put all to death except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. So they told Mordecai Esther's words, and Mordecai told them to answer Esther, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go, gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise, and so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. So in chapter 1, the king has the feast, right? And he calls for Vashti, his queen, who's renowned for her beauty, but she won't come. And the king is embarrassed in front of his friends. I think primarily there's peer pressure. And they say to him, "Listen, if you let your queen get away with this, we won't be able to get our women under control. You got to make a statement." And he's angry, and I guess he's embarrassed. And so he banishes Vashti somewhere in the kingdom. He says to her, breaks her heart, says, "You can never see me again." How do you like that woman? And you can hear her singing as she goes into exile. And so he says, "Well, this is what we're going to do. We're going to find another queen." And so I want all the guys, this is chapter 2, I want you, wise men, I want you to go out and I want you to round up not the smartest girls. SAT doesn't matter here. Not the women who could help him rule. He's not looking for Hillary. He's not looking for a co-ruler here. Not somebody who's sensitive and will be a great mother and raise an heir for him. He doesn't care about any of that. He says, "Go out there, round up the girls. We're going to find the prettiest one." And so the girls who want to be contenders enter the beauty contest. And Esther's in the beauty contest, and she excels. Now, I don't want to wreck your view of Esther here, but this is what I think is going on in chapter 2. I think that all the women, I think he went out and rounded up a lot of pretty girls. Pretty women, probably girls. And in one way, he married them all. That's my understanding of what's happening in chapter 2. They round up probably several dozen. He marries them all. They have beauty treatments for a year. Now, they all, from my understanding, they get to spend one night with the king. Now, they're married to the king, but this is the way this is going to work. Four things can happen from that one night. You go out, you all, you women, you pass the grade, taking you all back. I think I read somewhere that he had 400 wives in his life. So, sad. Not even 500, just 400. And so he brings them back, and again, one of four things is going to happen. You go into the king for that night, he just doesn't like you. If he doesn't like you, you get sent off to a harem and you never see him again. And you live the rest of your life like a nun. You never have kids. You never see the king again. You're never married because you're married to him. Maybe if he dies and his son succeeds him, he inherits the wives. And so maybe something happens, but you're not banking on that. That wouldn't be in your thought process. So that's one thing that can happen from that night. The other thing that could happen is he sort of likes you. And you end up being put in one of his harems in the capital city because he thinks, you know, I might want to see her again in a couple years or a couple months or whatever. I sort of likes you. I want you nearby. Or it could go pretty well. And he says, you know what, I'm going to put you on the inner circle of my wives because I really like you. And so you're close to the top. You're not going to be the queen, but you're going to be close. And what that meant was that if you had children with him, they could be contenders for the throne, which would be a big deal. Or you could be the one and you could become the queen. Now, out of that night, Esther is elevated to the queenship. Now, one question that I think you have is, why would she enter the contest to begin with? I mean, what kind of woman says, you know what, I want to be one of the 400? I think there's a couple things to say about that, and that is that we're so far removed because we live in a very Hallmark culture. I remember reading an article about Jacqueline Kennedy. And it was an interview of one of Jacqueline Kennedy's friends. And the question was put to Jacqueline's friend, why would she marry a notorious womanizer? And her friend said, when you ask that question, you show how little you understand. You don't marry a Kennedy for love. You marry a Kennedy for power and status. She said, that whole culture, that whole Northeast inherited money culture, all the men cheat. Jacqueline Kennedy's father cheated. All the men with their money had mistresses. The wife stayed home. She got to join the country club. She had kids. She lived a luxurious life. You don't marry for love in that culture. And I think that it's a similar culture with Esther. You don't marry a man with 400 wives to have a Hallmark romance. You marry a man with 400 wives, particularly in a culture that has no safety net. I mean, you could die of starvation in that culture. If you lived in that culture and you married a middle-class guy, that meant you worked your hands to the bone and you might have had 3 new robes in your life. You marry the king so that you live in a palace, you're always protected, you never have to worry about food, you have the niceties of life, you marry it as a career decision. And so Esther is chosen as the queen. Now, in chapter 3, what we find out is that Esther's now in the palace, but something has happened. Her cousin who adopted her and raised her, Esther's an orphan, Mordecai committed a social faux pas. Haman, who's the prime minister, runs the kingdom for the king because the king, you know, he's got the 6-month drinking party and the 400 wives. He don't have time to do anything with the state. So he's got a prime minister who runs it for him. When he rides through, he's a very sensitive man. He's got a very fragile ego. And he expects everybody to bow. Mordecai says, I'm a follower of the one true God. I only bow to him. I don't take the knee for anybody else. So there in Shushan, Haman rode by, everybody bowed, but Mordecai stood there. And Haman got his name, found out he's a Jew. And here's how sin works. Theologians use the term generalize. Sin always generalizes. Haman looks at Mordecai, says, I hate him. He disrespected me. But the more he thinks about it, he says, and I hate all the Jews too. Now that's the nature of sin. If you let it into your life, it spreads. That's how racism works. I mean, one person of the wrong race does something to you you really hate. And if you don't deal with that in 10 years, you hate everybody of that race. That one person that you don't forgive and they wrong you. And sooner or later, you look at them across the church and there they are And they got a bunch of friends around them. They're shown pictures from their vacation. And you start to hate all those people that are friends with them. Like, I can't believe they can't see through that joker. I mean, they don't understand what a dog he is. They have no idea how he wronged people like me. Look at him over there. And then anybody who says anything good about that person, they go on the list too. And I'm not crazy about them either. If you don't deal with sin, I mean lust, if you don't arrest lust, I mean, I assume, I don't know, I mean, when you if you have an issue with lust, it starts with one person. It was this one person I lusted after. But if you don't deal with that, you can't make it through the mall without lusting over half the women you see. Sin always gets a foothold, and then it gets a stronghold, and it generalizes. Sin is always specific. I disliked that person, or I lusted after that person, or I'm mad at that person. But if you don't arrest it, it just broadens out to everybody connected with them, every class that they're a part of. And here's Haman. It says, Mordecai disrespected me. As he thinks about that, he decides to go after the entire race. The king is preoccupied. King, I'm sure, sits in his office when he has to. And Haman brings in the stuff that has to be signed. Haman slips a little piece of paper in the big stack that says, on this day, everybody has in the kingdom can go after the Jews. If there are Jews in your town on this day, you can kill them, you can plunder them. On this day, it's go after the Jews with immunity. And so that's brings us to chapter 4. Mordecai hears that. He tears his clothes. He's grieving. He's in great distress. And Esther hears that. Somebody says, hey, your adopted father, that cousin of yours, he ripped his clothes. And she says, well, send him some new clothes. And so here you have Esther in chapter 4. And she is a queen in a storm. This queen in a storm. And there's an outer storm. In other words, there's this threat. I mean, if her life is this boat, there are waves coming up. She's in a hurricane because there are plots inside of the nation, plots inside of the capital to attack her. And I think that's where sort of Mordecai is getting at, because she initially isn't going to do anything. And he says, essentially, listen, you grew up in a place. People know who you're connected to. Everybody in the palace knows I'm a Jew, and they know we're related. If they come after the Jews, do you think you're going to be able to hide the fact that you're a Jew? I think that's the subplot of what's happening. So here she is, first of all, and she is in this massive outer storm. And you and I, fire life is a boat, if you use that analogy. There are storms that come up. There are financial situations. There are people that maybe we would like to have like us, but you get into places where lots of people don't seem to think you're a nice person or like you. There are issues that are related to our security, and this is what this is with Esther. It's a real security issue. It's an outer storm, but it's also an inner storm. I mean, if I don't know much about boating, but here you are, you got this boat. If you're in a storm, but the boat is secure, there aren't any holes in the boat, the motors work well, it's in fine operating condition, I think you're concerned about the storm, but you're not overwhelmed. But when the outer storm becomes an inner storm, That's the place where you start to worry and other people start to worry for you. I've always thought in my life, regardless of what happens with my money, if my money gets funny, and regardless of what happens at, I hate to say this, but even in many ways happens at the church, if my marriage is secure, if my faith is strong, and if my mind is functioning, if I see reality the way it is, I think I'll be okay because the water hadn't gotten in my house yet. Marriage is good. My faith is strong. My mind is working. But when you get into a situation where you have the outer storm and then there's water leaking in the boat and the engine isn't running, it's a really tough place to be in. My dad was a pastor, and you always, over the course of life, there are the things he says more than others. And I remember one of the pieces of advice he gave me probably 50 times in my life was, put your family above the pastorate, because the day will come when they'll be ready for a new pastor. And that's life. That's leadership to some degree. And they'll send you home to your family. You better be sure there's a family there waiting for you. And what he was saying was, if you have to have an outer storm, that's fine. But if you got an inner storm, if the storm has come into your house, if it's come into your head, if it's affecting your faith, if it's affecting your grasp of reality, that's a whole different issue. And that's where Esther is at. You got Haman, you got the extermination threat, but inside her head, now you have two or three things. First of all, you have ignorance. She's not seeing reality. Haman tells them to tell her what's going on. She doesn't even know what's going on. Now, there's three different kinds of ignorance. One is innocent ignorance. That's what your kids have, you know. You give them $5, they think that means they get five things at Walmart. That's not the way it works. It's innocent ignorance, you know. They ask you who's in charge, and you say, I am, but don't tell your mother. That's ignorance, you know. There's also the ignorance that comes from indifference. That's where you could know, but you've chosen not to know. You should know, but you don't know. You've reached a point where you should know the Bible, but you know far more about fantasy football than the Bible. You know far more about a player's groin injury than you know about what the Bible says. You could know, but you don't know. And there's an indifference there. And then there's the kind of ignorance Donald Rumsfeld used to talk about in those press conferences. That's where you don't know you're ignorant. You know, you just don't know. You think you know, you think you're aware, and you're not. And that's just sort of in between two and three. Surely she could know, but she doesn't seem to know. She seems to be living sort of like a Disney princess up there and not knowing what's happening on the street. And maybe she thinks she knows, but she certainly doesn't know. So she is not processing reality. And then not only is she ignorant, but then when she finds out, she has a spirit of incapacitation. Because she says, well, now I understand, but I don't know what I can do about it. I get it. The picture is clear. There's a plot to kill all the Jews, of which I am one, but I don't know what can be done about it. And then with the ignorance and with the incapacitation, it's just absolute fear. You don't sense that there's a lot of faith in her. I mean, at this point in Esther's life, I guess she's a Jew. Of course she's a Jew. Is she a practicing Jew? Is she a person who puts faith and trust in God? Probably not. And so now she's just overwhelmed by fear. Feels like the enemy's at the walls. And inside, there's just collapse. There's an inability to deal with what's happening on the outside. You get into that kind of situation, you ask, what can I do? I mean, what am I going to do? The city's surrounded and I don't feel strong. I feel very weak and the enemy feels very strong. What can I do in this situation? Well, there's some things you can do. Notice one thing you can do is you can pray. You can pray. She says, listen, I'm going to pray. You all pray. We're weak. The enemy's strong. Why don't we pray? That's always a good place to start. You say, I don't have the answer. Well, that's okay. There's one who does have the answer. Why don't you pray to him? You say, well, I feel weak. Well, there's one who's strong. Why don't you talk to him? You say, well, I don't know the way forward. Well, there's one who knows the way forward. Why don't you talk to him? You can pray. And not only can you pray, you can make up your mind to act courageously. I love this, and this is so important in verse... Let me see if I can get far enough. Let me see if I can get here. Verse 16, I think it is. This is. I don't do profound, but this is profound. She says, I'll go to the king. You pray. You get the order? We usually say, and there's nothing wrong with saying this, let's pray and see what the Lord wants us to do. Now, that's a good thing to do. I mean, praying is better than not praying. But it's interesting. She says, I am going to act courageously. I'm going to see the king. You've talked me into it. You all pray I don't get killed, okay? But I've made up my mind. I'm not praying of whether I should act courageously or not. I'm going to act courageously. You all pray. You all get my back and hope my head doesn't come rolling out of his palace. And you can make up your mind that I'm going to act courageously. I mean, that's what faith is. We talked about Ruth and how she goes with, we didn't mention this, but how she goes with Naomi. And think about traveling from Moab all the way back to Bethlehem. But she's going to be there with her mother-in-law. And she's going to stay with her mother-in-law and take care of her. But think about the treacherous road that she travels from Moab down to Bethlehem. Think about Rahab who saves the lives of the spies, and in doing so she risks her life. Think about all those people that are called faithful, and how Noah steps forward and says, I'm going to build the boat, and everybody's going to think I'm a nut, and I'm going to be, you know, the psychiatric case in my town. Nobody's going to understand what I'm doing, but I'm going to act courageously. Think about how Moses acts so courageously, and Abraham just takes the journey. You make up your mind. You make up your mind. I'm not going down doing nothing. The power of God, I'm going to do something courageous. Don't make up your mind to do that. I mean, I don't know if you're in a job situation where your finances are being threatened and there's pressure to conform to a culture of dishonesty. Basically, you've been told if you want to continue to work here, you'll continue to sign these documents, or you'll continue to act in a way that is against your Christian principles. See, I don't know what I'm going to do. I got a house payment. I got all these things going on in my life. What should I do? I think you ought to be courageous. I think you ought to just surrender. And nothing I can do except lie, cheat, and steal with the rest of them. You ought to act courageously. I mean, you look at your family, and maybe you've got an extended family and your kids, and it's ungodly, and there are just ungodly things that have been going on in your family generationally. So I don't know what to do. Well, I don't know what you can do either, but you can pray and say, I'm not going to lay down and act weak. I'm gonna behave courageously. I'm gonna do something. I'm gonna do something. Know what I'm gonna do yet, but I'm gonna do something. I'm not going to be weak, and I'm not gonna surrender to the moral situation of my family. This passage. There's been three times in my ministry that I would identify. And I'm not telling you what they are, but someday I'll write my memoirs. You can read about it. Probably three times in my almost 17 years of senior pastorate. And one of those moments, this was my verse that I hung on to. This was the passage that directed me in that moment. But it happened a couple other times where you're at this situation where if I address what I see as sin, or at least moral issues, if I do that, I risk splitting the church, because the situation is of such, there's a lot of different people on both sides. And if I split the church, my reputation will never recover. Or I can join with everybody else and ignore it and try to pastor in a situation. I was talking to a woman the other day. She said her family, she said, we had really lumpy rugs in my house. Everything got swept under them, you know. And then the question is will God bless that situation, and is it just a slow death if God won't bless us? Those are crucial moments. If you act, you may die. But if you don't act, what have you got in the end? You've betrayed your own sense of morality. You've betrayed your own sense of conscience. You've betrayed your own sense of right and wrong. You have risked the anointing that God has put on your life and on the life of the church. It's a tough situation. I think when you're in that situation, whether you're in a church or a family or a job, Esther would say, whatever you do, make up your mind to act courageously. And in each of those situations, I survived. I'm still in the ministry. You have to act courageously. And then as you act courageously, find hope in the fact that, again, God is at work. And I like Esther. The only hope she can grab a hold of is, perhaps I've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. I mean, that's all you got, man. Maybe the Lord brought me here because he saw this situation, and he sent me to be the answer to that situation. That's all I got, but I'm going to hold on to it, and I'm going to go into the situation with that in mind. That's all I got. You have to do that. You always have a choice whether or not you're going to pray. You always have a choice of whether or not you're going to act courageously in the face of conflict. You always have a choice of whether you're going to put your hope and trust in Jesus Christ and cling to Him in the moment. No matter what situation is, you can pray. You can say, if I go down, I'm not going to go down as a turncoat or a sniveler or somebody trying to take the path of least resistance. When I go down, I'm going down in the heat of the battle. I'm going to go down courageously. And because I believe in God, because I believe in a God who does miracles and orchestrates in the shadows, I'm always going to be hopeful. Maybe He always knew this moment was going to come, and I'm here for a purpose. I always make a decision to believe that. I remember when I was younger, you have those moments in the church that you never forget. And I can remember when Wayne, I was a kid, probably 14, 15. Wayne cheated on Marsha and got caught. And they were in the church, and it was a smaller church. So everybody knew Wayne cheated on Marsha. And it was bad for him because he had married in, but half the church was related to Marsha, so he wasn't looking good. And she probably wanted to divorce him, but she was thinking about it. So Wayne went to see Dad. I don't know how I came by this information. I guess Dad told me. But Dad told Wayne, listen, if you want her bad enough, you can keep her. The question here is, how bad do you want your wife? And Wayne said what any man would say, you know, the stress of the situation. He said, I'll do anything. Dad said, well, I'm glad you said that, because this is what you got to do. Next Sunday morning, you got to get up and confess what you did to that church, and you got to ask her and her family to forgive you. That's what you got to do. And to Wayne's credit, man, Sunday morning came, and he got up there shaking my head, put it all bare. And I still remember that, because all the men gathered around Wayne and comforted him, and all the women gathered around Marsha and comforted her. But I've been married now for 25, 30 years, got a couple kids. And I mean, make up your mind. You can pray. You can say, I'm going to do something courageous. Be courageous. Take a risk. And I think in Wayne's case, although he probably could not have enunciated his theology, he could say, listen, God's for my marriage. God's with this. He ordained it. Surely God does not intend for my life to blow up. Surely when He brought us together, He intended for us to stay together. I'm going to do something courageous. Something courageous. You have to make up your mind. You always have that choice. Those are always three options you got. You say, I'm out of options. No, you're not out of options. You can pray. You can decide, I'm going to be a courageous person. You can say, I'm going to put my hope and trust in Jesus Christ. If I live, I live. If I die, I die. That's where I'm going to stand. Why don't you stand with me?